This program has been brought to you by Cider Week New York City, happening November 6th through 15th, 2015. For more information, check out ciderweeknyc.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, cooking store located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes. Follow me on Instagram and Twitter, at Feast Your Ears. Today in the studio with me is Franco Lagna. Franco grew up in suburban New Jersey and discovered his love of cooking when he got out of high school. Culinary training in London and Italy followed. He went on to cook in Miami and a bunch of other places on cruise ships, which we'll talk about coming up here, and then returned to the New York metro area. He now cooks for events and has started his own line of products using Minnesota wild rice. He's working on a book. I'm sure I've missed some details, but welcome, Franco, to Feast Your Ears.
Thank you, Harry. Glad to be here.
Can you introduce yourself? If you meet somebody in an airport and you say, and they say, what do you do? What do you tell them?
I say, hi, my name is Franco, and I'm a chef.
Awesome. And so you, I did a little research about you on your website, and right. It talks about how, when you got out of high school, we're kind of afloat, adrift a little bit, and didn't know what you wanted to do.
I think most of us, especially back in those days, we're talking now 85, 86, 87. It was kind of a weird time in the United States. And I don't know. I didn't really know. Like many kids at that point in their life, teenagers, say 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. Food was the farthest thing from my mind. And I spent 20-plus years now cooking. Hmm. But back in those days where you're making those pinnacle choices as to what you want to do with your life, food wasn't even a thought or a conversation in my house or my family. And I was studying to be a social worker, actually.
Yeah.
And I was, a sociology major at a college in New Jersey called Kane College. And I picked up a part-time job because my parents pretty much wanted me to have something to do after school besides hang around and possibly go adrift and get more adrift. So I picked up a part-time job at a gourmet grocery store, so to speak, called King Supermarkets in New Jersey. They're pretty well known in the New York, New Jersey area. And I pretty much went in there with no anticipations of ever turning my life into food, just to make some money, car money, gas money, that kind of stuff. And the food just blew my mind. It drew me in. I wanted to learn and learn and learn and learn about all the things I was serving people.
Hmm.
Even from the smoked different salmons to the caviars to the simple potato salads, everything in those days was made in King's.
Oh, that's great.
They had chefs from CIA and so on and so forth. And I got under their wing and I changed my focus big time.
Oh, that's great. Did you, was there a lot of cooking in your house when you were growing up?
I come from an Italian-American household. I mean, it wasn't like cooking, I wouldn't say was the pinnacle of everything. My parents kind of got divorced when I was about 13, 14 years old. So food was more of just something to eat.
Right.
It wasn't really like mom wasn't sitting home making elaborate meals for us when we came home, though she did make dinner every night, and God bless her, she did well. But yeah, it wasn't a big deal like you would think for Italians and all that kind of stuff. We had definitely pasta and gravy and meatballs and all that stuff every Sunday.
Sure.
But it wasn't really like a very center focus at all, no.
Speaking of food, here's the pizza that we ordered. We're sitting here at Roberta's and coming through, and you said, oh, look at the pizza. You said you weren't going to have any.
This pizza's looking delicious. While you talk, I'm going to take a picture.
So we did just get that delivered. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Jack.
Just brought that in for us.
Delicious.
So you went to culinary school, and then in a couple different places, right? You did some time in London and time in Italy.
Yeah, I actually, because I flipped my career I was trying to really, now I'm speaking to people that are really stuck someplace in their life. Like if you're not sure what you want to do with your life, I'm sure everyone's been there. You're looking at a Y in the road or several roads ahead of you and you don't know what career to choose or if you want to change your job or your career. That's exactly where I was at. I had no idea what I was heading into when I was going to be a chef. There was no one in my life, no one in my family, no friend, anything. So I went to a local community college, which my parents, again, did not want me to do. They want me to continue to become a social worker and maybe do food as like a hobby. And I went to a local community college in Jersey City, New Jersey. It's like a stone's throw right from here. And I graduated with a two-year degree in culinary arts, like an associate's degree. And then from there, I bounced to London, the Cordon Bleu, which was a fantastic experience. I lived there, and I worked in the Dorchester Hotel and some little French bistros down the Soho section of London. And I just knew once I got out of the United States and I got abroad that I got the travel bug. I'm just going to rock this thing. Like most young chefs, they want to pick up their knife kit and rock the world. I was the same.
I mean, it's a great way to get around, right?
Right. You can always find a job.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't really need to speak the language. As long as you can kind of follow what the food is and what the recipes are, what they're cooking, you can get by.
Right. Yeah. Sure. And eventually that led you to Miami, right?
Well, I had a good friend when I was in London, and I was running out of time on my visa and all that stuff when you're young and you're traveling. You know, you squeeze the visa right to the last second and all that stuff. So I had like 3 days left on my visa, and I had to get out of the country and either redo it all over again or whatever. And I had a good friend of mine from culinary school that was working down in London and studying at Florida International University. I think that's up in Fort Lauderdale area. And he was living in Miami Beach. So I was not even home back in New Jersey for probably a month. And I was in an airplane flying down. I had never
been to the beach.
Right. Again, London to Miami is two different worlds. So you couldn't be completely any more different, so to speak. So
sure.
I was never even in. I think I was in Orlando with my folks when I was like 12 to go to, you know, right before they got divorced to go to Disneyland. That's all I knew of Florida. So Miami Beach is much different than Orlando as well.
Right. Yeah, I was in Miami during a hurricane once in the 80s. I don't know which hurricane it was, but I was down there. We had family in the hospital down there, and so we went to see this family. We got stuck.
Right.
We got stuck because of this hurricane on Miami Beach.
It gets pretty hairy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The food memories I have of Miami are a couple. I remember great Cuban food.
Definitely.
Obviously. I remember the Cuban coffee.
I was going to say.
Stand a spoon in that stuff.
I'm still hooked on Cuban coffee.
Yeah, I mean, that was really best hangover cure I think there is that super sweet Cuban coffee. And, of course, Joe's Stone Crabs.
I live a stone's throw away from Joe's Stone. That's pretty much where I spent 10 years of my life. Yeah.
And from cooking in Miami, you ended up on some cruise ships, right? I mean, there's obviously lots of cruises go in and out of Miami.
I mean, Miami's one of the busiest cruise ports in the United States. And when you live near Jones Stone Crab House, it's only about 3 or 4 blocks to the inlet of where all the ships come in and out. So every morning, I mean, I'm a young guy. I'm like 24, 23, 25 years old. All this stuff is exciting and new, and you want to rock it. And these boats are, for a young guy, I mean, they pulled me in. I just wanted to work on one of these cruise ships so bad, I didn't even know how to begin. And every time I would submit a resume or, you know, kind of like try and find a way to enter into the corporate, to get into H&R and all that stuff, it was almost impossible. Most of these cruise lines use like agencies, and the agencies hire outside of the United States. So Americans aren't really hired for the galley. That would be the kitchen.
I see.
And everyone told me I had. So bottom line is, fast forward, I had one roommate, my roommate from New Jersey, who was going to FIU, and he was living with a guy who was a waiter on a cruise line. And he kept saying to me, they will never hire you. They don't hire Americans. All the years I've worked on a cruise line, I've never saw an American in the kitchen. It's all like Europeans. Most likely the guys who are chefs are Europeans, and the workers, the cooks and all that are like Southeast Asians and stuff like that. You'll never get hired. And first of all, he's like, why would you ever want to do that? And I'm like, because I want to see the world. I want to rock. I want to do it. I want to cook. It's just like a macho thing to do, you know? And I basically called this bluff. I said, I'm going to get a job on a cruise line. I'm going to drive down to the port, and I'm going to just kind of like see if I can. I had no clue. Walk on one of these boats and ask to see the chef. Like I would walk into
just like you would get a job in a restaurant.
Right. And they marched me right back around, and they said, you know, you're crazy, but if you can go into this building over here, and you could probably talk. There was a building where there was a bunch of men and women outside with their suitcases and stuff. And I waited in line. It was like 100 degrees in Miami, sweating. I get into this. It was like a trailer, kind of like what we're sitting in, with a little air conditioner. And they were hiring new recruits. And these people were just new sign-ons to this huge cruise ship that was behind them. And the woman actually gave me the right time of day. And she asked me if I had pastry experience. I said, I just came back from London, and I worked in the Dorchester Hotel in the pastry kitchen. She said, do you have a resume? I handed her my resume. They got all kind of commotion, and she said, could you be a pastry chef? I said, definitely not. I can assist a pastry chef, but I'm not going to tell you I could be the pastry chef. So she said, well, hold on. And fast forward, long story short, about 4 weeks later, I'm sailing off to the Caribbean on a cruise line, and I've been bouncing on off cruise lines for 10 years from that. Yeah.
And yeah. So how is that, you know, so you end up on this giant boat.
Giant boat. Right? The only American, they were right. Ah. There was no other American in the galley but me. It was 187 guys in the department, men and women, and I was the only guy from the United States. So that was true.
But you proved your roommate wrong.
Yeah, I proved them wrong. And he was pretty like happy because he thought that Americans should be on there. But then again, obviously, he owed me like a beers for the rest of my life or yeah. something. So he still owes me beer, probably, right?
And right. So when you're working on the ship, I mean, I've never been on a cruise myself. Have you been on a cruise as a passenger?
I have.
Yeah.
It was weird. I didn't go on a cruise as a passenger until maybe 5 years after I kind of left and I saw the other side of it. And I got to tell you, it's much nicer to be on the other side, for sure. I'm sure you can imagine, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a David Foster Wallace essay called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. Mm. I don't know if you've read it.
I have not, but it's sounding interesting.
It's about going on a cruise. He was, as I understand it, he was hired by a travel magazine to write an article about going on a cruise.
Oh, okay.
And that was the article he submitted, was about how, what a strange experience it was to be a passenger on a cruise.
So apparently he was not a fan.
No, he didn't like it.
And what cruise, I mean, I got to say this just for all the listeners out there. I mean, the cruise industry is pretty sectioned off in terms of like levels. Like you have basic cruise lines, you have party cruise lines, then you have these super luxury cruise lines. I mean, the first cruise line I worked for would be like your, I don't know, kind of like average cruise line, mostly family oriented. So there's not much play with food. There's not much action. It's very rigid, you know, in terms of the menus and things you're going to do.
And are you just, are you generally serving like cafeteria style, like in three meals a day?
Yes, and I was kind of disappointed too, because here I am coming from Michelin Star Europe, and I'm landing in a thing where we're slopping stuff on a plate. And, you know, you didn't get to, it was more about the adventure and learning and working with different people from all over the world in a huge food preparation environment. I mean, I suggest everyone who's going to become a chef to spend at least 6 months on a cruise ship. You'll never complain when you come work in a little kitchen again. You really won't. You know, well, this doesn't work. It never works on a cruise ship.
Right.
You'll never, by the time they fix the blender, you'll be retired.
I mean, right.
Right. So that's my.
And how does it, you know, the cruises, I mean, obviously the passengers only go out for like a week at a time. Do you get stationed as someone who works on the ship for 6 months, a year? Like, what, you know, what is the. What's the timeline?
It's very rigid. It's always very like military in terms of like status. So if you are considered to be an officer, you probably work 3 months and then you're off for 4 months and you have a much more nicer type of working relationship with the cruise line. If you're a low man on the totem pole, which most kitchen galley people are, you know, they're coming. And most of those guys don't even have much skill. They just want a job. So they say, okay, you can be a dishwasher. These people are really looking at me. To get to the brass tactics here, most of those people come from those third world countries. They're just really trying to better their lives.
Sure.
You know, and they see this as a major opportunity. They're not looking to rock the world, cook all this great. They're looking to like
They're looking to make money, right?
Yes. I mean,
because you're there.
Send money home.
You're on the boat. You have a place to sleep.
And
right?
food.
And food.
And you're safe.
And you're getting paid.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're trying to help their family, their children, their wives, their mother, back home. You know, it's a whole different thing. And they really work. I mean, without those guys, those ships wouldn't move. You know, so, I mean, you're talking 8 months, you're talking 12, 13 hours a day, you're talking no days off for those guys. And, you know, most of them do it with a smile.
Right, right.
You know,
and did you ever get to get off the ship, or are you just on the ship?
I was lucky. I was educated enough to where I was able to finagle 6 and 5 month contracts. So I would get off. I made sure, and again, getting off the boat, the ship, we should say, they hate it when you call it a boat, the ship. Well, they'll look at you funny. The ship itself is kind of like, your home. So they really don't like the fact that the minute you pull into a port, you want to run away from your home and go see, you know, like the management, so to speak. They really would love you to hang a little bit and schmooze with the customer, the guest, not customers, the guests, and, show some, like, you know, comfort, relaxation, that you actually enjoy being on this boat, the ship, not run off and become a tourist and hit the thing hits. But I got off as much as I could, and I saw a lot. I saw a good portion of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you learn a lot from the folks working in the galley who were from other parts of the?
I did, because when you're working with these people from all over the world, you start to learn about their, in terms of culinary arts, you start to learn about what they like to eat and what they like to celebrate with. Because if you're out on the ocean and you're working 8 months, 5 months, 7 months, whatever it is, you're going to start crossing into holidays and cultures that you don't even know exist.
Right.
Yeah. So they're cooking stuff, and it's like, the Jamaicans are making this crazy oxtail with celery root and all this stuff, and it's some sort of a holiday in Jamaica, and you have a good portion of the people on the co-workers on the ship that are Jamaican, and you learn, you talk, or people from the Philippines, or people from South Africa, whatnot. It's a terrific place to expand your palate and to talk with people, learn about their culture. So that's the part that's really... The perk.
Yeah, no, sounds like a really great way to learn about all those cultures without having to travel to all the places.
Right.
Not that traveling to those places wouldn't be great.
And get paid for it.
So, right. And then eventually you became the first American chef to be in charge of an Italian restaurant, right, on a ship?
Yes, which was a big deal for someone like me. I mean, I'm an Italian-American, so like for me, I had to learn a lot of stuff. Like I said, my house wasn't full of all this wonderful food. It was just food to eat to then go do your homework or go whatever you're going to do at the end of the night after going to school all day, those younger years. But as I got older, I just educated myself via, the culinary arts, going to school, and then just learning, going out there in the world. I left my comfort zone like a million times to learn and stretch. And, being the only American, I met a lot of Italian guys, a lot of people from Southern Europe. That's the kind of food I really like to cook, that Mediterranean cuisine. So you can, all day, for 6 months, 13 hours a day, you can converse about recipes. And I've swapped more recipes than I can imagine, yeah, like in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. So I came back, and I came back to the United States, and I went to further my education in Asti, Italy, a school called the Culinary Institute of Foreigners in Castiglione di Asti. It's a little town outside of the Asti-producing area of Italy in the Piemonte region. I graduated with my Master Chef certification. When I came back to the United States, I was able to enhance my career to the point where I would even be considered to be an Italian chef for a luxury cruise line. I mean, the culinary director at the time was Jacques Pepin, so it's pretty serious.
Yeah.
And he was like an idol, so to work for him, it was like, working for your favorite rock star, your favorite baseball player. I mean,
right.
It was like, wow, and I watched this man cooking on TV since I was probably like 11 years old. My mother actually watched him.
My 6-year-old daughter loves watching him.
So to work with him, and even to work, I mean, you don't see him much, but when I did see him, I did get to serve him. It was really a pleasure. And I realized, I worked hard to get to this place because I had, no food in my life. I had to go find it.
Right.
So to get that job and to run that department was really nice. Yeah.
That's awesome. We're going to take a short break. Franco and I are going to eat a piece of pizza, and we'll hear from the sponsors. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about your Minnesota Wild Rice Griddle Cakes product that you brought us. Thanks.
We go wild.
And the break music today, courtesy of Keto. We will be right back.
I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we're the ladies of We Dig
Plants.
And today we're asking you to dig deep into your pockets and help us grow this radio station and our podcast and everything that you know and love about us.
How do you do it? You go to the heritageradionetwork.org website. You will see a beating heart. It's on every page. And you can give $1. You can give $5. You can give whatever.
$500.
$500. $5,000. Just click on the heart, donate, and help support the radio that you love.
Cider Week helps to bring profitability to local orchards while reviving heirloom apple varieties by cultivating awareness of craft cider. Cider Week connects cider makers from New York State and select pioneering guest cideries outside the state to buyers from top restaurants, bars, and retail shops across New York City. Those culinary tastemakers, in turn, help increase consumer awareness of cider's pleasures by hosting public events, tastings, dinners, classes, and pairings that build appreciation and demand for regional ciders.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and with me today is Franco Lagna, chef, author, spent a lot of time on cruise ships. Before the break, we were talking a lot about Franco's time on cruise ships and how he became a chef and where he studied. I want to turn the conversation now to your products.
Okay.
You went from New Jersey to becoming a master chef to running an Italian restaurant on a cruise line to discovering Minnesota wild rice. Can you tell us about the product?
You connected the dots pretty well. I mean, to connect the dots onto the product, I was a advisory board chef for one of the biggest food companies in North America, and they were out of Omaha, Nebraska. And for 5 years, I was going out there, and I built a lot of relationships, especially with the company. I like them. They like me very much. And they sent me to Minnesota in, I think, 2013 to headline a fall and holiday cooking show at the Swans Culinary Center. And it's like really the first big shindig for me. I mean, there was probably 1,000 people in the audience, chefs from all over, and I was supposed to be like the headlining chef who's going to wow the audience with all this kind of, you know, fabulous culinary creations. And I did a pretty good job, if I do say so myself. And after the show, the men in charge of the men and women in charge of the program invited me to have some Midwest fun. And for a guy who's coming from, you know, New York, New Jersey area, I don't even know what that means. Midwest fun to them is to go shooting, to go to a bison farm, to drink some beers, walk around, enjoy the beautiful autumn they were having. And, you know, that was their way to say thank you so much for rocking it out for us and doing such a nice job. It was a spur-of-the-moment thing for me. That was, like, the whole, like, drum roll about it was, like, I was thrown into this thing, like, a week before the show, so I didn't have much time to think, prepare, what items am I going to cook, what am I going to say, so on and so forth. So I pulled it off, and we went around, you know, the kind of local area in Marshall, Minnesota, where the Schwann's Culinary Center is. And I was kind of like doing a lot of work for SMSU, giving lectures and talking to the students about being a chef and therapeutic cooking, because that's something I've also written about and talk about, being a 9/11 survivor. And some of the people kind of knew me from that. So when I came for the show, that pulled them in. They wanted to see, well, now we can finally see this guy. And when they took me around, they took me to all the things that they thought that I would like to see, like a bison farm and things like that. And obviously going shooting. It was like target shooting. One of the fellas, the bison farm was near the target shooting place. So we're doing some clay shooting. We're having fun. Obviously, I'm a guy from New Jersey. I can't hit the broadside of a barn, let alone a clay flying at like 50 miles an hour in the air. But these guys, you know, they're patient. They're showing me their teeth. Whatever. We had a really nice time. At the very end, they have like a club. It's like a lodge near the shooting club. It's called Shooters, of course. And they have like a little kitchen, and they invited some of the people from the town, the mayor and this and that. And this guy from back east is going to cook them dinner. And some of the people that own farms in the area were brought in kale, and they brought in pumpkin, and they brought in some of the bison. So we're making a big pit, and we're grilling stuff and all this. I'm in this little puny kitchen. One of the fellas comes in, big guy, big cowboy hat. He reaches above my head in the kitchen, and he pulls out a big bag of wild rice. Now, wild rice is the state grain for Minnesota. So these people, like, you know, they've had wild rice in every way.
Right.
So he says, can you do something with this? It's been up there for a long time.
You know, none of us knows how to cook it.
We've had enough. We're hoping you'd bring something Italian from back, you know, east. And I'm like, okay, you know, I don't want to disappoint him. I'll think of something. And when he left, I Googled myself on my phone. I have like one bar because we're in the middle of nowhere in this like farmland. And I do a risotto griddle cake. So I tweaked it and incorporated the Minnesota wild rice. And then I kind of dumbed down the Italian flavors and made it more for, like, say, the average American palate. And I made these now wild rice griddle cakes on the spot, and I cook them up, and I put them out. And then I figured it's going to go really nice with the bison and the kale and the pumpkin, the fall, the whole spiel. I throw it out there, and these guys devour it. They devour it because wild rice is something they wanted to try different because something they get all the time.
Sure.
And one of these fellas came back, the same guy that handed me the wild rice, and he had said, you know, you really should think about boxing this. Now, at first I thought he was joking because, you know, are you serious? He's like, no, I'm not dead serious. And he hands me his card. He works for one of the biggest supermarket chains in the Midwest. He's like a director of a certain area in Nebraska. And, you know, he thought that this is something I should really contemplate. Lo and behold, I ran home, I formulated it, I did research on wild rice. It's a great source of iron, protein, fiber, antioxidants. I mean, I can't speak more highly about it. It's an all-American ancient grain. The rice isn't coming from outside the country.
Right.
It's keeping jobs in the USA. I get it packaged and boxed in Lancaster because the flour inside of here, I found a nice Miller PA dry mix in Pennsylvania that actually makes it for me. So it's an all-American product as well. And I just ran with it, and we did really well. It got received well in the Midwest, and we just started creeping this way, Pennsylvania, and we even made it out onto Long Island. So we're at the Wild by Nature stores in Long Island, which is really nice.
Oh, that's great. And we'll definitely – I'm going to take this box back, and we'll test it out at the Brooklyn Kitchen. And
maybe we'll be there.
Perhaps we'll bring it in there as well.
I'll come and do demos for you if you want.
That'd be great. No, I mean, it looks great. I'm really excited to – I'm excited to try it out.
Thank you.
See what my six-year-old says about it.
Children love it.
I'm sure.
They really do.
Yeah. It looks awesome. And do you have any – are you expanding the line of product?
I'm going to be expanding. Thank you for asking that. I'm going to be within, like I'd say, the next 2 months, I'll have a gluten-free version of this. So I had to go back to the drawing board, reformulate the box design and everything. And the gluten-free version, I'll say after Christmas, will be out in the market. I'm already getting pre-orders for this.
Are you using a gluten-free flour then?
Gluten-free flour, specifically milled by an Amish fella out in Lancaster. He has a phenomenal flour. It's much higher in protein and all kinds of nutrients than, say, your average gluten-free flour. He does a really nice job. So you pay a little more, but you get more. Taste is way better. As a chef, I don't want to put out something that tastes like cardboard. I mean, I'd rather just not. So my thing's all about it has to taste good before I even think about putting it out to the market. And then from that, we're going to move into gluten-free pastas.
Oh, with the same flour.
Same flour, but we got to tweak it with this, that, and the other thing. But the base is the same. Hmm. And we're going to do a gluten-free pasta line. So,
and that'll be a dried pasta?
Yes. Like nice. Kind of like long fettuccine, so to speak. We'll start with that.
Great.
See where it goes.
I look forward to trying those products as well.
Excellent.
It sounds really cool. You mentioned therapeutic cooking, and you mentioned 9/11,
right.
Which, you know, I was in the city for as well, and you know, I don't mean to take the interview into you know, to be a downer, but I think these things are important to talk about. And you know, 9/11 was a huge huge event in New York City, in this country, in history. I definitely feel like it's the thing that I will tell my grandchildren about.
Definitely.
having been present for it. So can you talk a little bit about where you were and what happened and how that affected your work as a chef?
Yeah, I mean, like, people that know me or follow me kind of know the story. Most of the listeners out there probably won't. But, I mean, I was at that point in my life where I was going for, say, a change in my career. I didn't want to leave my career. I wanted, like, more, like somebody going back for their master's or going for their doctorate. I was at that point where it was time to go back to school or possibly, like, get out of the kitchen, go more into management or whatnot. I had gotten married, where the child's on the way, the whole thing. So it was time to, like, find a way to make more money at this craft. And I went back to school, like I had mentioned. I went to Italy, and I graduated. I wound up working in Michelin star restaurants in Milan and all that stuff. And I came back to the United States when it was time to come back, and I landed in New York, I think, probably like 2 months before I got this job. So I was 2 months looking for a job, and I was picked up by the BR Guest Restaurant Group in New York City. They own
many
of you guys know them. They had Fiamma at the time. The Blue Water Grill is one of their well-known places. They have many restaurants in there. So I came in for an interview. I cooked for the chefs and the corporate chefs. I had just come from Italy, so Italian cuisine was on my fingertips, doing it all day. And I landed the job. I mean, by the minute I finished the demo, and not the demo, the cooking kind of like a, I would say like a class, whatever, to show them what I could do. They hired me, which was great because now it's like a first real job, benefits, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. 401k. Stability,
normal. This is exactly what I went away for to come back. You know, the whole thing is like, wow, you know, this like planning your life actually works, you know, instead of shooting from the hip all the time. And I got the job, great. And I went home to tell everyone I received this great job, nice salary, benefits, the whole thing. when I got home, because in those days we didn't really do the cell phone, I was back to the old answering machine. My answering machine looked like it had a message. I played. It's the guys from the corporate office, Be Our Guest, saying, you know, congratulations, whatever, but we reviewed your paperwork and your Department of Health and Mental Hygiene certificate, basically your food handler certificate for New York City, has expired while you were in Europe. You'll have to retake the test. No big deal. Company's going to pay for the classes. We'll give you the book. We'll give you the refresher course, and yada, yada, yada. And you'll be lined up to go take this test someplace near where you live. There's three places in Manhattan. One was in the Bronx, one was in Midtown, and one was like in downtown in the World Trade Center. I lived in Jersey City, so I was one stop away from the World Trade Center.
Right on the PATH train.
I chose there. Of all the days, I was scheduled to show up at the World Trade Center on 9/11. Obviously, not knowing, no one knew what was going to happen. It was a gorgeous, beautiful day.
It certainly was.
You know, riding high, thinking everything's cool. Like, class starts at 9 o'clock. Like a good student, I get there like 8:30. I sit down. I'm waiting for some other colleagues to come in to kind of like talk and, you know, refresh what this whole test is going to be about. And, I mean, not to go into the details or everything. Everyone knows what it did. Yeah. Boom. You know, and brutal. It took me 13 hours to probably go 2 miles to get home. I mean, I was trapped, and I saw a lot of stuff that was just, I'm sure you can imagine. Yeah. And from that, I kind of went into it. Everyone has those moments in their life where sometimes things are riding high, and for some apparent reason, everything just goes wrong. And it went right from so right to so wrong in like a matter of a week. I wound up finally breaking up with a marriage that really wasn't that great. The whole thing, it just, and my life spiraled down, 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 down. And I gave up all aspirations. Here's a guy who rocked his whole life for cooking, and there was nothing that I even thought about other than not wanting to cook anymore. I slept in cookbooks. I stepped over cookbooks. I had recipes and notebooks every place. I had bags full of pictures. I was the typical want-to-rock-it-out culinary guy that you see today, that they're all over TV and doing all that. That was my world. I mean, and it just all went poof. It went away. And to come back, to fast forward this, to come back, I started to realize that, you know, what was the real reason why I ever went to cooking in the first place? And I went to it because it inspired me, it enlivened me, it made me happy, it made me feel good. That was the bottom of my mind, feel good. I wasn't feeling good. And I started to approach food just from that very beginning point, you know, the grassroots of why I ever went to go cook. I didn't go to cook to become a rock star. I didn't go to cook to be the next Iron Chef. I went to cook because it just made me feel damn good and I loved it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and if all that stuff happened, great. But if it didn't, I didn't care. And I started to bring myself back through these, like, reconnecting with the stove, looking at it like an old friend, therefore, that was willing to give me, like, say, a warm embrace every time I approached it. Like, you can do this. Reassurance. Because my life unraveled. And to get back together again, or to orchestrate a plan or a way out, you need to get nutrients. You can't walk around smoking cigarettes, drinking orange soda, and eating pizza all day like I was doing, because your life kind of implodes. And and then it's always, woe is me, woe me.
Yep.
You go more. So to bounce back, I used this kind of a mentality. And from that, people around me started to say, you know, this could be really something for other people. You know, because as I'm working, I'm so you should write a book. Everyone's telling me I should write a book. You know, I mean, again, this is what I had no idea I even how to begin to write a book. And make a long story short, this is when I went on the cruise line. I started to pull myself together. I got that Italian chef job. I went from like the floor to like now being like the Italian chef of a luxury cruise line. And I used to come down into my cabin at night while everyone's running around partying, because, you know, cruise lines are a big party atmosphere behind the scenes. I'm sure everyone knows that.
Sure.
You know, and I'm done. I was just done with all the partying. I've done plenty of that in my life, and I was over it. So I would go back to my room at night, grab myself an orange soda, unfortunately, my pack of cigarettes, throw them on my thing, and I would sit there and write until like 2 o'clock in the morning and pass out, work all day. At the end of 6 months, I had like 100-something thousand words, which I turned into this book, and hopefully, I say within the next 6 months or so, I can get it out there. I have an agent here in Manhattan shopping it around. So
that's right. And the book is about this idea of cooking being able to inspire and be a therapeutic action
for yourself. So basically, using certain aspects of a recipe to draw you into the recipe, like the sautéing, the roasting, the frying, the chopping, even the washing. It's a very fundamental way to look at food. But if you look at it with an open mindset and you're looking for reassurance, at the end of the recipe, you've created something that most likely you never even would have attempted to do.
I mean,
you're not feeling right. You don't feel good. The last thing you want to do is even walk around a grocery store and go shopping. So I'm talking simple stuff. Go in, grab a chicken breast, an onion, a stick of butter, and a jug of olive oil, head out. You don't need to go run around looking for a fancy list of recipes.
Sure, and the thing that's so great about that and about, you know, we do 50 cooking classes a month at the Brooklyn Kitchen.
And, oh, cool.
And the thing is that it really, you know, inspiring people in that way to understand that they can do this.
Right.
Especially, I mean, you know, and I'm not talking about people who necessarily are in this sort of depressive mode and, you know,
right,
all down all the time, but the idea that, you know, the thing that's so great about it, and it's the reason, one of the reasons I love to cook, is that you get to make something with your hands.
Yes.
That's delicious, right? And you get to share it with other people
and
often.
Watch them smile.
Exactly.
Well, that's what also starts to wake you up again. And then also on the flip side of this, cooking also is a great way to celebrate. So to get out of a difficult moment, it's awesome. But also to celebrate the fact that maybe you did get the job promotion, you did achieve the college of your dream, you know, to hit the stove in that manner too. But I started to focus on people that are stuck, because those are the ones that are wasting time in life, and all we have is time. And that's how I looked at it. You don't want to spend 5 years trying to get over something.
Right.
Or 10 years trying to, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you just don't. Your clock's ticking, we're all ticking. So that was how it started. But it's also a great celebratory way. We all know that. That's what the holidays are all about.
Sure.
We're heading to the holidays.
And you have to eat every day. So
right.
Might as well,
exactly.
You know, might as well get something from
and,
it. Right?
And feel trampolined about it, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think that's great. I look forward to the book. And I
cool.
think that the discussing cooking in that way. I mean, we talk a lot about top chefs and special recipes and special ingredients and all that stuff.
Right.
But the idea that really the cooking is also about you, or about, you know, about yourself, about the inside, and about how it makes you feel, and
right.
about being able to ground yourself through that, I think is super important.
It's feel good. That's really what, I mean, you want people to feel, I always wanted people to feel good when they ate my food. I always wanted people to feel good about themselves when they tried to go cook a recipe of mine. You know, so it's passing the love forward.
Yeah.
What good is it to keep it all to yourself, right?
Well, that's great. Well, thank you. We're out of time here today.
Thank you.
Feast Your Ears. But if you want to know more about Franco and his wild rice griddle cakes, his book and things like that, you can find him online at francolagna.com.
Excellent.
We'll put a link in the show page. And thank you for listening today to Feast Your Ears. A big thank you to Kristen Baylor, my producer, to Jack Inslee for engineering the show today. And take a moment to like the show and Heritage Radio on Facebook and iTunes. And if you really like this show and you like listening to Feast Your Ears every Wednesday, or even if you don't listen to this show every Wednesday, but if you listen to other shows here on Heritage Radio Network, Heritage is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we're coming up on the end of the year. And, you know, if you do enjoy this, please consider going to the website and clicking on the beating heart on the website and, you know, give us a little change, a $100 bill,
$1,000,
whatever you got, whatever it's worth to you. That would be great. Thanks very much.
See cool. You Thank week. You, Harry.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.